Xcel Energy Services, Inc. versus Labor and Industry Review Commission and John, is it Smolchik? And we have, first arguing to us today is Attorney Matthew P. Bant, who is representing Xcel Energy Services, Inc. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you indicated, I'm Matthew Bant. I represent the petitioner and appellant, Xcel Energy Services, in this matter. Before I proceed, I would like to thank the court for granting our petition to review. And before I get into the merits of the underlying appeal, I'd first like to address the two procedural issues. The first one being whether the circuit court complaint should have been dismissed due to my client's insurer not being named an adverse defendant. The second one being whether the Court of Appeals had authority to review the circuit court's denial of the commission's motion to dismiss on those grounds. It is my client's position that Ace American Insurance was not a necessary party. The statute 102.23 clearly states the adverse party shall be named a defendant. Contrary to the Court of Appeals decision in this case and in Miller 1, nowhere in the statute does it say that all parties must be named. The purpose of the statute is to give notice to any parties that could be affected adversely by the appeal. Ace American Insurance Company is not such a party. This matter involves one employer and one insurer. Ace's interests do not conflict with my client's efforts to set aside the finding of permanent total disability. If my client prevails on the appeal, so does the insurer. They have no conflicting interest in the outcome of the appeal. Furthermore, to the extent that the statute is intended to give notice to the parties, Ace has effectively been given notice by the fact that my firm represents both the employer and the insurer in this matter, as noted in both the underlying ALJ decisions. The statute also, not just the adversarial part, but the statute talks about naming defendants. It would be illogical to name our insurer as a defendant in this matter, since the commission's decision finding permanent total disability was in no way favorable to Ace. The only logical thing would be to name them as a plaintiff, but the statute does not require the naming of plaintiffs. In Miller 1, the Court of Appeals defined adverse parties to include any party bound by the commission's order. In contrast, this court in Miller 2 adopted the definition from Black's Law. They adopted the definition from Black's Law Dictionary that an adverse party is a party whose interest in relation to the judgment or decree appealed from is in conflict with the modification or reversal sought by the appeal. The insurer in this matter also wants the permanent total disability finding to be reversed. The insurer's interest is not in conflict with that appeal. Assuming this court still applies the Black's Dictionary definition, then Ace certainly would not be considered adverse because they would be in favor of the reversal of the permanent total disability. In no way would the reversal harm Ace Insurance, and therefore under Black's Dictionary, they should not be considered adverse. To hold that all parties must be named as defendants in this matter, as the Court of Appeals has indicated, would actually create a conflict with the statute and the case law, thus possibly resulting in a floodgate of dismissed claims. A party should be able to properly plead a case by reading and following the statute. A party should not have to do appellate research just to figure out how to plead a case. As this court stated in Miller 2, and I quote, "The statute should not be a trap for lawyers and litigants. It should be easy to ascertain which parties must be named as defendants," end of quote. If the case law contradicts the plain meaning of the statute, then the case law will in effect create an even bigger trap than what may already exist. The Attorney General's office in their brief, they assert the notion that this court is bound by the holding in Miller 1 that all parties must be named. As I cited in our brief under State v. I don't know how to pronounce it, Duangamala, Duangamala, according to that case, this court is not required to adhere to Court of Appeals interpretation of statutes that are objectively wrong. As I've already argued, it's our position that the Court of Appeals interpretation of the statute is objectively wrong. Furthermore, I don't believe that this court would be bound by Miller 1 because I think in effect this court already reversed that holding in Miller 2. This court noted in Miller 2 that it is unclear from the statute as to which It is unclear from the statute as to which parties must be named as defendants. Now, if Miller 1 is saying all parties must be named, and then this court turns around in Miller 2 and says it's unclear which parties should be named, you can extrapolate that the court is saying, no, you're not right, not all parties are named. It's actually unclear which parties should be named. Nonetheless, I think the Court of Appeals interpretation is objectively wrong and it should be ignored. If for some reason this court finds that ACE was a necessary party to this matter, we would further assert that this is a technical defect, a harmless technical defect under 805.18. For that support in our brief, we cite the Seladen case, S-E-L-A-I-D-E-N, versus Columbia Hospital. And to that extent, I guess I would just refer to my brief in that regard. Moving on, if it's okay, I would move on to the second issue. Otherwise, if you have questions or however you want to do it.
I've got a question, Justice Prosser.
The Court of Appeals indicated that it felt it was bound by the decision, that it was bound to follow the decision in Miller 1. You want to comment on that?
Well, as what I had started to get into, as far as this court being bound by Miller 1, I think I would defer to their arguments in that, but I believe what they're saying is that because the court did not specifically reverse the holding in Miller 1, then therefore Miller 1 has become good law and has become precedent. However, in response to that, I would say, as extensively indicated in the brief, that doesn't apply here because this court upheld Miller 1 on the grounds that they were adverse parties in that case. The Court of Appeals, and really what amounts to dicta, just went out and flatly went beyond what it needed to do and said all parties must be named, when really all the Court of Appeals needed to do was look at the facts and see that in that case they were clearly an adverse insurer. And if you want, I can go through those facts, being that was a case that involved one employer with two insurers.
What should the Court of Appeals have done about Miller 1?
In our case?
Yeah.
Procedurally, that's a difficult question, but they may have kind of had their hands tied as far as how they had already ruled in Miller 1 and sort of deferring to the higher court to fix what amounts to a holding that wasn't even applicable to the case that they were deciding.
Well, Counselor, aren't they bound to follow our decision if we modify something in another decision? I mean, as I read Miller 2, we certainly talked about adverse parties and we clarified what was required. So I was a little mystified by the Court of Appeals feeling it was bound by Miller 1, to be quite frank with you. I mean, they're bound by what we say, and certainly they can't change their own opinions, but we can, and Miller 1 talked about the same thing, so I'm not sure why it isn't the proper conclusion that we did, in fact, change their decision.
Yeah, and I have to admit that in preparing for the argument today, a light bulb went off in my head that yes, in fact, this court did mention that the statute is unclear and it's not a bright line rule like Miller 1 had stated. And unfortunately, that argument may have gotten lost in our briefing.
Okay.
Well, what did Miller 2 say about Miller 1?
Miller 2, as far as Miller 1. Specifically, well, this court in Miller 2 said that my interpretation was that Miller 1 had created a bright line rule that was not necessary to the set of facts. And then in Miller 2, this court went through all of the definitions of adverse party and listed multiple reasons why in that case the parties were adverse. And then there was the comment by this court that the legislature should you know, maybe step in and clarify, because this has become an ongoing problem, but the legislature has yet to do that. And really, I think the legislature has spoken by doing nothing, meaning that we have to go by the plain language of the statute, and applying Black's Law Dictionary, Ace American Insurance is not an adverse party.
There's a footnote, let's see.
Footnote 8.
8. While the Court of Appeals applied this court's interpretation of adverse party in the same manner as we have, the Court of Appeals also concluded that an adverse party under the statute includes, quote, any party bound by the commission's order or award granting or denying compensation to the claimant. Court of Appeals also concluded that the term adverse party includes parties who may have differing interests in the outcome. It was according to the Court of Appeals, therefore, that it was an adverse party. Then it says, because of our holding, we need not determine the validity of the Court of Appeals equating adverse party to a party bound by Lurk's decision. So it didn't say Court of Appeals was right as to its definition of adverse party. It didn't say the Court of Appeals was wrong. It said we don't have to deal with that because we're dealing with it in a different way, right?
Yeah.
So isn't the question, does Miller 1 live, or is Miller 1 squashed by the Supreme Court? If it lives, then the Court of Appeals is right. Cook might be binding on the Court of Appeals. Miller 1 is binding because Cook says it's binding. If Miller 1 has been terminated, exterminated, put out to pasture by Miller 2, then it's not binding on the Court of Appeals. So how do we interpret this fuzzy language in footnote 8, which I wrote?
I certainly agree with the first interpretation that if Miller 2 quashed Miller 1, then, you know, it's a slam dunk, and Miller, and we've already addressed the issue of whether all parties have to be named, and the finding was no, the holding was no, they do not. If opposing counsel can kind of, you know, pick apart the decision and find that Miller 2 did not reverse that holding, what I would say to that is that Miller 2, the court in Miller 2, set aside that issue for another day by applying just the facts of that case to that situation.
Well, now you've done a good job of squarely presenting the issue to us, so we see what the problem is.
Could I ask the Ace Insurance Company, American, whatever it is that the same as St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company?
I don't know their history. I do know that, what I do know is that XL is, each claim has a $2 million deductible, and then Ace would pick up thereafter per claim, and that CCMSI is the third-party administrator for the claims, but I don't know the history as far as whether they are St. Paul Fire or not.
So there may be an insurance company that covers the first $2 million.
The XL self-insured for the first $2
million. That's what we're asking. So St. Paul would not have covered the first $2 million.
No.
Ace covers thereafter, so you don't know who St. Paul is.
Yes, that's correct.
I thought I heard you suggest that maybe it's like a claims administrator.
Well, there is a third-party claims administrator who, they're the ones who make sure the checks get to the claimants.
Yeah. But that's not St. Paul doing that as a separate company.
That's a separate contract, a separate business relationship. They have no obligation to pay or anything.
All right, so what do you want us to say? Do you want us to say Miller 1 is dead? Do you want us to say by Miller 2? Do you want us to say that you don't want us to say Miller 1 is alive, do you?
No, I would say that the most judicially efficient, decision that would make the most sense would be, at least to clarify for someone who, like me, didn't catch it the first time, that Miller 2 did, in fact, reverse the holding that all parties must be named. And apparently, the Court of Appeals didn't catch that interpretation either.
How can we say that when the footnote 8 says, because of our holding in this case, and you inserted the words, we save for another day and do not determine the validity of the Court of Appeals equating adverse party to a party bound by the decision? How can we say that Miller 2 reversed or changed or altered when it saved the issue for another day?
Well, if that's the interpretation that the court adopts, then it did not reverse that holding, but now the court is not bound by that holding because it's objectively wrong.
The Dwang Mala.
Well,
yeah.
Would the insurance company have been a party whose interest is in conflict with the modification or reversal of the administrative decision sought by the action for judicial review?
No, the appeal was, we were appealing the finding that
they would have been on your side.
Yeah, Mr. Smotsik was found permanently totally disabled. The insurer doesn't want to ultimately have to pay that if the claim exceeds $2 million.
So that's in Miller 2. One of the definitions at page 716 of adverse party.
Yes, yes.
Well, to what extent are you adverse if the claim is less than 2 million?
I didn't quite catch
that. To what extent is ACE adverse to Excel if the claim is less than 2 million? You're not adverse. You just wanted to come in under 2 million. Excel may want it to come in at nothing.
Well, they're certainly not adverse. They would be neutral, I suppose.
Well, if you're not with me, you're adverse. I mean, some people argue that way, right?
Well, that would be speculative to say if the claim were to come under 2 million. I would say that this is a very expensive claim, and that's certainly a possibility. And XL is paying the bills for everything, so it's XL's money. So ACE is not at any detriment by us proceeding with the appeal.
Counselor, I want to move a little bit to the second issue, which is whether there's substantial credible evidence to support the finding of permanent partial disability.
Uh-huh.
And part of that in your brief involved whether LIRC could make such a determination when there had been a prior determination that wasn't appealed, that there wasn't a permanent partial disability. So I'd like to look at that a little bit, but I want to look at it in light of the relationship between physical disability and a disability that is also an odd lot disability. Does that make sense to you, how I'd like you to focus it a little bit?
Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
Okay, all right, thank you.
I guess, actually, could you please explain?
It was I got going on too many things, probably, okay? The first thing that's here is, does LIRC have the ability to make a change in something that was done by the ALJ when that determination that there wasn't a permanent partial disability at that point was not appealed?
And that's permanent total disability?
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay.
Can LIRC do that? And if they can't, why not? If they can, why?
I couldn't find a whole lot of case law on the significance of interlocutory orders, but that's what it comes down to.
Yep.
And, you know, under the interlocutory order, the The commission reserved jurisdiction for further findings and awards consistent with Judge Trammell's order. Now, Judge Trammell's order said that it's premature to assess permanent total disability because he had not proceeded with the recommendations. I couldn't find anything on point on it to compare that to, but based upon, again, I guess the plain language of what the order says, then all future determinations would be subject to those, to her findings.
Okay, now if it's just an interim order, I guess the question is, doesn't LRC have the ability to modify that order when it enters its final order?
Well, certainly on appeal, which there's a procedure to modify her decision on appeal, I couldn't find case law suggesting one way or the other as to whether the commission can modify an interlocutory order when the interlocutory order says that its jurisdiction is subject to being consistent with that order. I'm just going by what the order says. I don't have any statutes or case laws to explain the significance.
Okay, so if in fact you think LRC couldn't modify it, then we shouldn't uphold LRC's current order. Now, let's just assume that LRC could modify it. They have that power. Their order is not inconsistent with her order because it is a final order. Do you have to have a total physical disability in order to be 100% permanently disabled if the odd lot doctrine applies?
I didn't research that issue, but it's my understanding, no, you do not.
Okay. And in LRC's findings, I believe they make their decision based upon the odd lot doctrine, correct?
Yes, they do.
All right. So then I guess if they can do that, is it your argument that there's not substantial credible evidence to support that, or why should we conclude that determination is incorrect?
Well, if it's kind of a bit of a mix, a crossover between the first issue you're talking about and the second issue, because if the law of the case is that it's premature until he proceeds with this treatment, then you would move into that. It gets into whether they had a reliable and reasonable and credible evidence to support their decision. And the only way that they would have credible evidence is if you agree, if the treating physician's change of recommendations was credible. And we argue that that change was not credible because there was no change in the employee's symptoms from the time that the treatment was recommended until today. And he still hasn't undergone the treatment as far as I'm aware. And in fact, actually, he testified at the second hearing after the first hearing. Well, as of the first hearing, it was clear what the treatment plan was. Then the judge issues a decision, says because he has not proceeded with the treatment, it's premature to assess permanent total disability. Mr. Smotzek's attorney then turns to one of the treating physicians, discusses the order with him, that's Dr. Hebel, and then Dr. Hebel puts in his notes that he'll contact Dr. Schlimgen to see if he has the same recommendations after reviewing the judge's decision. I question, what does the judge's decision have to do with the proper treatment recommendations?
But the treatment was for physical impairment, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But even without a total permanent physical problem, he can still be totally disabled under the odd lot, can't he?
I think so, but the significance here is that if he proceeds with the treatment, he could get better. The purpose of the treatment is to take away the pain, which would then result in increased exercise, functional capacity, and then hopefully result in him not becoming permanently and totally disabled.
Okay, so what you're saying is you might lower his symptoms enough that he would no longer be odd lot.
Yeah, and I'm expressing the opinion of Judge Trammell, because until he exhausts the reasonable treatment options, we don't know if he's permanently disabled. It's premature.
Okay. All right. That's a big help. Thank you.
So what do you want this court to do?
If you were writing this opinion, what would you write, counsel?
What would I write?
Yeah.
I would write that the Court of Appeals was mistaken in that the case law that they're holding was in fact reversed by Miller 2 in the sense that it's still questionable as to what parties need to be named. Therefore, we are still relying on sort of this mixed bag. I'll step back. I think it would be safe for the court to, my time is up.
You can continue to write the opinion.
If I had the honor to write the opinion, I would say that until the legislature clarifies what an adverse party is, the most clear, what provides people with the best notice is to go with the dictionary definition, as the court already did in Miller 2, and that since the court has already adopted the dictionary definition, in effect, Miller 1 was reversed, and that holding is not good law, then moving into the second phase, getting to the merits of the appeal, I'm just thinking out loud here, obviously. I would put that the treatment that there's, well, I think the easiest way to get at it would be to say that there is not a credible, there's not substantial and credible evidence to support the decision that it is no longer premature to assess permanent total disability, because there is still a treatment option out there that has not been pursued, and the doctor's changing of the treatment plan is not credible. And therefore, the commission's reliance on that change, they are relying on non-credible evidence.
So what would you do?
Reverse
the Court of Appeals? Reverse the Circuit Court?
I would reverse the circuit court and remand it back to the commission with instructions to issue an order consistent with the decision of the Supreme Court.
Under what provision of, I always forget, LERP doesn't come under 227, it comes under 102, is that right?
Yeah.
So under what provision of 102 authorizes the court to remand it with instructions?
The original appeals to the circuit court reviews the commission. If the circuit court were to reverse the commission, then as we keep moving forward, it's always, the review is always of the commission. I don't have the statute in front of me, but since you're reviewing the commission, it'd be my understanding you could either reverse the commission's findings or remand their findings, because those are the findings you're reviewing.
Okay, so you think there's a statute that says you can remand and tell them what to find? Because that's what you're telling us.
I know that you're reviewing the commission, and maybe you can only reverse them. And of course, I would be okay with that, certainly.
Just as long as we reverse them.
Yeah, being plain nice, I guess, or being fair, it seems like they would have the opportunity to reconsider their decision based after applying the law as it should be.
We could send it back to the Court of Appeals.
That is an option as well. You could, on the procedural issue, reverse the Court of Appeals, and since they did not address the merits of the underlying appeal, give them the opportunity to do that.
But the underlying merits are here, right? They have been briefed. The underlying
merits
have been fully briefed, in your opinion.
And if we get to the underlying merits and the court elects to address them, that would, at least from our perspective, be judicially the most efficient and potentially the most efficient to this court as well, in case there's another petition for review, if it were to be remanded to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Richard Moriarty, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Conson representing Lurk. Counsel?
Thank you. Good morning. I am Richard Briles Moriarty, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I wanted to point out first that while counsel correctly answered questions posed by the court, there's absolutely nothing in this record at the agency level or the circuit court level that indicates what financial arrangements exist between the insurer and the employer, whether or not there's any cutoffs, whether there's contributions, responsibility, absolutely nothing.
Well, it was your motion or Lurk's motion that it was improperly filed, so it was your burden to show that there was a problem with what was filed, correct?
Our motion was a motion to dismiss based on lack of competency to proceed because of the Miller 1 decision and its holding. Here's a party that throughout the proceedings was a party to the proceedings, listed, appeared, participated, and yet was not made part of the circuit court.
I know, but they holding. Have to be
so
the
there's no
party.
Obligation on our part to prove a negative, for example, that the insurer had some economic responsibility based on their private arrangements that they may or may not have had. We're based on the agency record, what we have before us, and so I don't believe, Your Honor, there would be any, certainly as a movant, you always have to prove your...
You have to prove the person that was left out was an adverse party.
Yes.
That's your obligation.
Correct. And okay. Under Miller 1, that is one of the ways that a person or entity is an adverse party.
But under Miller 2, if you use the dictionary definition, ACE doesn't fit, right?
Ah. There we get to what happened with Miller 1 and Miller 2. And if I might, here's an analogy. This court in Miller 1 was taken to the head of a woods. The question is Twin Cities an adverse party or not? There's not a clear road, one clear road going through the woods with bright lines on both sides created by the statute that says this is the way you find out if Twin Cities is an adverse party. The court looked at its guidebook, its prior decisional law, and found there's three different types of paths that we've defined in our prior cases by which you can answer that question going through the woods. Sometimes those paths intersect. Sometimes they're on the same, they go together, but they're three different paths. This court looked also at the four, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What are the three paths that you're telling us about? Why don't you tell us?
There are the three paths that are defined in the Miller 2 decision, and also I think noted in the Miller 1 decision. Those three, I can go to them and.
At page 716?
Yep. The three different approaches. A party in whose favor an award has been made is an adverse party. That's one. That's one path. A party whose interest is in conflict with the modification or reversal of the administrative decision, etc. That can be different than one. You can have some people in that circle that aren't in this circle, but they might overlap. Three, a party whose interests were adverse to the appellant during the administrative proceedings. That's a third path. Three different ways that this court has defined in addressing specific factual situations for how you determine, is this an adverse party? Now, the very fact you have these three approaches and these three different paths for making that determination indicates this is not a clear, unambiguous issue from a statutory point of view. We have three different ways you get there.
So which one's the insurance company? Which of the three paths is the insurance company on?
In this particular case, it may fall within the number two, conflict with modification or reversal. And if I could defer on why that's the case for a moment, let me go right to that. We have a situation where Excel, the employer, files a petition for review. The insurer, as far as we know, isn't even aware of that proceeding. It may have paid...
Wait a minute.
Excuse me?
Wasn't the insurer represented by the same counsel?
Correct. But the court has no basis in this record to know one way or another whether the insurance, whether the insurer is even aware of this proceeding. Maybe they are. If they are, if they were consulted and decided not to join in, that creates questions about why not.
But why would they be in, if Excel wins, which is sort of, if Excel wins their administrative or their review of the administrative decision, how is the insurance company displeased with that?
Okay. If we assume, we have no knowledge of that, those economic relationships, but we must assume the insurer has economic obligations to the worker one way or another. If Lurk's decision is reversed and it's sent back for further proceedings with Lurk, there are a number of possibilities open to Lurk. And you're right, Your Honor, you don't, the courts don't direct, here's what you're gonna do, Lurk. It's sent back to Lurk for further proceedings. Here's some legal guidance, we go from there. But Lurk ultimately makes these benefits decisions. There are a lot of different options available. You could have a situation where Lurk looks at it again, comes up with a different end of healing date. We could have different benefits that are ordered. We just don't know how that could all play out.
But it was your motion, and I would think you would have to have had proof of everything you're saying in order to establish that ACE was an adverse party that should have been named. And that's where you're kind of losing me, because you're telling me it's not in the record. So if it's not in the record, I mean, it was your burden.
On a motion to dismiss, the movement is required to at least put forth a prima facie case.
Exactly.
Here's why. And under Miller 1, the insurer was bound by the Lurk decision and yet was not named. So based on Miller 1, right or wrong, for a moment, let's just assume Miller 1 is a valid holding.
Sure.
It's a valid holding. Therefore, lack of competency to proceed.
Why?
Based on Miller 1 stating to be, you have to include those bound by the Lurk decision, and the insurer was bound by Lurk's decision.
Adverse means in opposition to, okay? And XL and ACE would both like to have this decision overturned, mm-hmm. but if you have put something in the record to say that ACE wants the decision to stay in place, and Excel does not, then I guess you could get my interest on this issue, but you're losing me factually.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm sorry I'm being so slow.
Not at all. I understand. I think what we do, Justice Ziegler asked, is there any of these that it could fit within? I think it could fit within two, but that's not the primary way, by any means, where
but
ACE becomes an adverse party.
When you answer Justice Rogensack, you're going to answer my question, too, because I don't get why they aren't on the same team.
Okay. The fourth path that Miller 1 had defined, and which this court noted in Miller 2, does not require that these two entities, you know, be on the same page or otherwise. They're bound by the order, both of them. Under that fourth path defined by Miller 1, the insurer was an adverse party who had to be made a party here in this circuit court proceeding. And the issue is, we have Miller 1 and Miller 2 and the effect of those two decisions on this case. If we were here today on Miller 1, and I was arguing that the validity of that fourth path, it would be quite a different argument.
That's because there were two people, and if you change the date of injury when you got two insurers,
yep.
then you have someone who is brought in that wasn't in before. But that's not where we are at all here, so that can't possibly fit.
Factually, that's distinguishable. But Miller 1, in reaching its conclusion, in achieving the resolution it did, expressly stated, here's why we're doing it. It's because even assuming that we have no variance in the interests between the parties, Twin City was bound by the decision, therefore, it had to be named. It's a holding, it was not dicta. I'm sorry.
Okay, all right, well, I understand what you're saying. I think we're talking past each other just a bit. If you can explain to me factually why today, or when you filed this motion, mm-hmm. ACE and XL are adverse in interest, that would help me a bunch.
Okay. I don't think I can articulate on this record whether these two are adverse. They may well be. There are an awful lot of things that occur beyond the record between employers and insurers where there may very well be interests that are contrary, but they don't show up. They join together for the purposes of the presentation before the commission in the agency proceedings. They prevail, don't prevail, but then you have a situation where an insurer was not named. We don't know why. It could be that the insurer looked at it and said, you know, we don't think the challenges are the kind of challenges we can buy into. We are a little concerned, frankly, maybe even about bad faith. There could be that conclusion. We just don't know.
Counselor, when I go back and look at the Court of Appeals decision, I'm going to look at the record. And I'm going to either say, yes, there's a record that supports it because they are adverse, or no, there's nothing in the record to support it. So I can't look at what might have been or could have been or should have been. I only can look at the record, and that's what I'm having some difficulties
Understood, Your Honor.
With.
I hope I'm understanding you.
Okay.
I think what is occurring, Your Honor, is the focus here you're having is on the three paths that the Supreme Court defined, and the separate fourth path that the Court of Appeals defined, you're essentially saying, I don't buy it. I need to find it's within those three. And that's fine, but the problem is Miller 1 did define that fourth path. It did define it as a holding. And what this court is now faced with is, do we overrule that holding or not?
Or have we overruled it?
Have we overruled it? I do not believe, I'm sorry, you're gone. Go ahead, Your Honor.
No, but Justice Prosser wanted to get into this.
I'm sorry.
Get in the act, too. I'd like to ask you a hypothetical. You're an attorney representing XL and ACE before LURC. You lose. You want to go to circuit court. You're preparing the pleadings now. How would they have read?
As pretty much every workers' comp petition I've seen over the last several decades, with some exceptions, you got parties on the caption of the commission decision. Those parties show up on the judicial review petition. It's very rare that you don't see that happening.
Yeah, but tell me exactly.
I would have put ACE and the employer as plaintiffs and the others as defendants. Now, if the insurer does not want...
You're not following the statute.
Okay.
You're not following the statute then, because your position is that ACE is adverse.
Yes.
And they have to be named as a defendant under the statute.
They are adverse under Miller 1 to the worker. And under their definition of what it means to be adverse, they're bound by the decision. They were at
I'm going to follow the statute. I'm not going to follow the Court of Appeals. I'm going to follow the statute. And you said that you would have named ACE as a plaintiff. Okay, but statute says an adverse party shall also be made a defendant.
And that is something I have seen as well. I'm talking about general practice. The general practice is you put the employer and the insurer
but, I mean,
on the plaintiff's
side.
But
you are relying on the statute here to say these folks cannot take their case in front of the circuit court And it's absolutely fine that they don't get any decision on the merits. Well, the merits are one thing. We don't know what the merits are here. But you're saying we're going to cut them out because they violated this statute. How can you do that?
Well, it wouldn't be me personally doing that, Your Honor, but it would be the court decisions, the holdings of both this court and the Court of Appeals about what adverse party means. This court in Miller 2 said, we have three designated paths, and the Court of Appeals sees a fourth path. We don't need to evaluate the validity of that fourth path because we're looking at the established ones and we see that this particular case falls within two of those. Left it for another day.
This
whether
is
or not.
Another day.
And this is, this is the other day. However, the standards have changed because now we have a Court of Appeals decision that, with Miller having been affirmed on other grounds, becomes a holding. And the question is, do you overrule that holding? Under this court's decisions with Bloom and with the prodigy of Bloom, you have to be very concerned about extending beyond the scope of the Bloom holdings what happens. In subsequent cases, this court looked at it and said, wait, when we reverse a Court of Appeals holding, that leaves the other holdings in place. When we withdraw a Court of Appeals holding, that leaves the other Court of Appeals holdings in that decision in place. It's only when we overrule.
I'm not so sure we made that kind of a declaration on reversal.
In Bloom, no, but in subsequent decisions, Joshua S., et cetera, in those subsequent decisions, the court looked at this and said, well, what are the parameters of the Bloom decision? Well, when we reverse, those other decisions remain in place. It is only when we actually overrule a holding within the Court of Appeals case that the entire decision goes away, that the Miller 1 would be eliminated and thrown on the ground. So that's what we're faced with, and that's what the court is faced with. What do you do about Miller 1? It's a very strong standard. They have to show a compelling, they have to basically show Miller 1 and its holding on what adverse party means is objectively wrong. Now, is it objectively wrong? You have a situation where we've talked a little bit about plaintiffs and defendants, and perhaps we should point out, plaintiffs and defendants, it's not like what used to be bride and groom on either side of the aisle. Plaintiff, under the statute, simply means someone designated as such in the complaint. Defendant means someone designated as such in the complaint. And in 80303, under the joinder statute, if a party should have been a plaintiff, this is what the statute says, a party should have been a plaintiff and does not want to be a plaintiff, the court can designate them as a defendant. So those distinctions aren't as firm as one might think. So what we have is, yes, you must name an adverse party, any adverse party, in the 102 petition. What does that mean? You can get there by one of the three means that this court referred to in Miller, or under the Miller 1. Unless this court, looking at that fourth path, finds it justified to actually overrule Miller 1 in that regard. And that's the stiff standard that Excel had.
You know, the problem is, and we face this problem in another context, and that was, and I think it was the statute that says an aggrieved party can appeal.
Uh-huh.
I think it was that.
The 227 context.
And we were getting a ton of cases as to who's aggrieved and why and how. And I, if my recollection is correct, which it might not be, we finally said, it's up to the administrative agency to say, right, who it is. So the parties don't have to make the decision, and this court doesn't have to make the decision. And Miller 2 was a 1993 case, and I can't remember why we just didn't take the Court of Appeals decision, and if I could remember, I wouldn't tell you, because it didn't. But we're faced again with what does adverse mean? And if you just read Miller 2, you know that you could be adverse in any number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that the records don't show adversity. I mean, that was the whole point about Miller 2 and the whole discussion about the Brandt case, which was a 1992 mm-hmm. case. Because all the relationships between the party are irrelevant in the administrative agency and are not part of the record.
Precisely, Your Honor.
And you have to be put to the burden of proof, you'd have to have a lot of discovery, which would delay this cause of action. And we're dealing with workers' comp, and we're dealing with paying somebody who's been injured.
And here we have a worker with that very injury, that payment being delayed.
That's right. And so what has to be done in these cases, and I think that was in Miller too, we said, legislature, please try and fix this up, because this is a real problem. Well, I don't know if Lurk ever went to the legislature to get it repaired. I don't know if employer interest went to the legislature or labor interest went. But here we are, what, 20 years later, and we're still fussing with this. So what is a solution that's practical for this court to deal with? And the concept of switching sides of the V, as you stated, you could be a plaintiff and you don't want to be, you can be a defendant and you don't want to be, and mm-hmm. there are ways of naming it. You're a defendant, but you really are not. So, I mean, what's a practical solution?
And in that sense, Your Honor, if somebody is misnamed on the wrong side, they can always get realigned. That doesn't create competency issues. You just name them, and then they're there. As far as a practical solution, let me say that the Court of Appeals' fourth way does present a very good, simple, practical solution, and that is, if you're bound by this order, you need to be named. We can get at it one of the three different ways that the court identified in Miller 2. But if you adopt or just allow, actually you don't adopt it at all, you just allow that Miller 1 holding to remain in place because you're not overruling it, then we have a situation where basically a simple rule. You're bound by that Lurk decision, name them. Put them in the caption. It's very easy, it's a simple rule, and it works.
Is ACE bound by the circuit, since it's not a named party, is ACE bound by the circuit court opinion, or is it bound by the Court of Appeals opinion, or would it be bound by our opinion here if it's not a named party?
That creates a very important issue that was identified in Miller and otherwise, that it absolutely was bound by the commission decision. No question about it.
No question, because it's a named party and it specifically says it.
And you, insurer, must pay. However, not having been named in the review proceedings, is it bound by these other court decisions?
A common law principle, or doctrine, of course, is, and statutory, is claims preclusion. And being a party to the same action, mm-hmm. of course, is one of the elements of claim preclusion, whether or not you can raise the issue again or whether or not you're bound by it. And if you're not mm-hmm. a party, then you wouldn't be, under common law, you wouldn't be precluded. Your claim would not be precluded now on issue preclusion. We haven't had that, but...
But what about privity here?
Yeah,
does it matter whether ACE is bound by any of this? Because aren't they bound by the insurance contract, which is pay up if their client is liable?
Correct. However, you could easily have insurers making arguments, we didn't get due process when Lurk got reversed and this other order came in that waxed the insurer for more. We were quite happy, and take it away from this case, because this applies across the board. An order that basically is very, you know, satisfactory to the insurer. They thought they were facing a big claim. Lurk ends up deciding here, employer appeals, insurer's not named, reversed, remanded. Lurk comes back with a big claim against the insurer. Did the insurer get due process, not having been involved in the judicial review? No. Could I just quickly say, on the merits of the case, I think my brief adequately relates why those claims are do not allow for any.
I'd like you to address one part of that.
Sure.
Your time seems to be skipping by because we spent so much time on this procedural matter. Okay, it is opposing counsel's position that because the earlier order, the interlocutory order, was not appealed, which says it's premature to determine the permanent level of disability until these reasonable treatments are attempted, that you can't now find, even under the odd lot, permanent total disability. Would you address that a little
bit,
please?
Yes. There's two aspects to that. The first is, in that decision, the administrative law judge was essentially saying, okay, you got 2 years within which this treatment stuff is supposed to occur, and if it doesn't occur within that 2 years, then the employer can come and say, hey, you know, we should be done. Within that two-year period, the Lurk decision, 8 months before that two-year period ended, the Lurk decision came out and resolved the issue. It was certainly interlocutory until that point. And the we have the treatment issue, which we want to then jump back and look at the record. We have the doctor essentially saying, you know what? Maybe this treatment is an option. I don't advise it. I don't think it's a great idea. I don't think it's going to work for you, but we need to keep it in the mix. That's when it goes up for this first ALJ decision, and that first ALJ looks at it and goes, well, they didn't try that reasonable treatment, so we need to keep things open. It then goes back, and the doctor looks at it again, and for the doctor's own medical purposes, basing his analysis on medical reasons, he said, I really don't think that treatment option would help at all. I just don't. I conclude that. Consistent with the prior view, but more firm at this point. Excel's counsel tries to turn that into a conspiracy to end the case and to get workers' compensation benefits when, in fact, it's a matter of a doctor very honestly looking at the situation, thinking there are various options available, not thinking very much of that particular treatment option, but leaving it on the table, coming back, and then taking it off the table later. Because the pain at that point was focused on the legs, and that was inconsistent with those treatment options. So on both issues, on the merits, Excel has not presented valid reasons to change the commission order. Certainly, Lurk has the ultimate authority and can always change these orders. They're interlocutory by nature. And as this court well knows, when something goes up on appeal, then the court, in the same case, then this court has the authority to do a lot of different things. On the actual substantive evidence, the doctor's evidence was, the evidence about the doctor was clear. He just simply refined his opinion on the treatment option, took it off the table, end of story. Now we have end of hearing, order entered.
Right, and Lurk did find that the vocational expert said he was odd lot, permanently, totally disabled, was more credible than the other vocational expert.
It did go all to credibility, that's correct.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel,
yes.
We get
used to words like interlocutory order and final order, and I just don't recall. But my sense is that even when, like, you have a permanent total disability in order from LURC, that it isn't a final order in the sense that we think of in normal civil appellate practice, because they are continuing orders. They continue jurisdiction. They continue jurisdiction in order to make subsequent orders as may be required in this case. Is my recollection correct?
That's quite correct, and you'll find that in this order as well, that LURC has the ability to go in and issue further orders, and that suggests we're not done yet with this thing, and we could have other issues arise.
So our normal, as we said, is in civil cases or whatever cases, criminal cases, and we think of as this interlocutory order, as a final order, that sort of dichotomy doesn't exist, because even when they're not done, because it can be, as here, you say, a continuing order forever.
And that's, in fact, I'd say workers' compensation has so many specialized things that can happen procedurally. It is difficult to look at circuit court proceedings and say there's any correlation. We have, and it's one reason we have all the confusion, I think, over the adversity issue, too. So, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Moriarty. Counsel Bunt? Bant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Just briefly addressing the procedural issue and the statute as far as naming adverse parties, one suggestion was that the Miller 1 holding, the bright line rule, would kind of clear everything up and then we never have any problems, but I disagree with that. First of all, I don't think it would be appropriate, I don't think the court, with all due respect, has authority to ignore the language of the statute in the first place. And then, but beyond that, I also don't think that would be this great solution, because then the question becomes not who's adverse, but who's bound by the decision. So there's still some clarity issues there as well. Like, for example, you know, relatives are bound by the decision. Down the road, there could be a dependency claim. Do relatives all need to be named in the caption? Medical providers at this point aren't being named in captions, but should they all be named in the caption?
Counsel, is ACE bound by the decision of this court if they're not named as a party?
And that was going to be my second point, is that ACE is bound by their insurance contract. And furthermore, we represent both the employer and the insurer. And as I believe it was Judge Ziegler had mentioned, you know, we're a team in this matter, and sometimes, as you know, counsel has suggested, that the insurer may not agree with how the employer is proceeding or vice versa, but someone has to make those decisions, and as a representative of both parties, and at this point, the employer, whose money it is making these decisions more than ACE, but ACE is bound by that decision under their contract.
My concern is we have to be careful of the facts. In this case, you may be you're not here today representing both because they're not a named party, but in the underlying matter before the commission, you were representing both. But that's not always true. So why not just say, hey, this is a technical, even if they should be named, it's a technical defect.
Well, I'd say because the statute doesn't say that, but and as far as the notice, for purposes of today, if that was to be the holding, I would say that would have to be a perspective. And I don't know, and that doesn't seem like that should apply in this case, because we went with what the statute said, and we went with the plain
meaning. No, I'm trying to give you a bone. I'm saying, you know, I'm trying to say, probably I'm not saying it clearly, and that is that even if they should have been named, regardless, you know, define all this, adverse here, adverse there, you know, who knows. Even if they should have been named and we didn't name them, failure to name them is a technical defect because they are, I think you have paragraph 2 and paragraph 3 or 4, something in the complaint. I mean, they are certainly prominent in the complaint, everything about them, is prominent already in the complaint, so that failure to name is merely a technical defect. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, and that was addressed a bit in my brief, the statute, well.
802 something, yeah. Another three maybe.
And, yes, I'd agree that would be a technical defect, and under the Saladin case, there's the outlines under what circumstances is a technical defect harmless, and this case would certainly apply to that. As I recall, the most important one being whether they have notice, and they certainly have notice since we represent them, and they are bound by the decision because they are under contract.
Who do you represent here?
Well, we all along, our firm still represents Ace American Insurance. They're not listed in the caption, but we do represent them.
And you represent Excel?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to address opposing counsel's arguments on the merits? Which essentially was that the doctor changed his mind because the focus of the pain changed to be in the man's legs. So the, quote, reasonable treatment that had earlier been suggested was no longer a reasonable treatment for what he was experiencing?
Well, when he agreed with the recommendation for the facet injection, that was November 26, 2007, Bates number 183, at that point, he did address that he thought that the injection would be more for hip pain, not so much for leg pain, but after addressing that, he went on to say, and I'm quoting, I certainly cannot rule out the facet joints being at least a contributor to his back and hip pain. I think it would be reasonable to consider a medial branch blockade to determine if the facet joints are contributing to this portion of his pain. So I think he clearly stated back in November 2007 that was his recommendation and that it was a reasonable recommendation and that nothing changed from then until he changed that recommendation. The only thing that changed was the decision in between.
Okay, thank you.
And I see my time's up if there are any more questions.
I have a brief question. You said that XL is covered, that ACE provides the insurance contract to XL, and that therefore ACE would be bound by the decision of the court in this matter, of LURC. Yes?
Yes.
Isn't it bound? By reason, and the only reason it would be bound is because of its contract with XL.
As far as off the top of my head, yeah, that would be the reason.
And if ACE were to pose a defense, such as your opposing counsel suggests, such as we weren't brought into this matter, we didn't have a chance to argue it, so therefore our due process rights have been violated, who winds up paying whatever judgment is due?
Well, under the contract, up until $2 million, XL Energy, and then beyond that, it would be ACE.
Okay, and if ACE is found to not be liable because it wasn't brought into the action, who winds up paying?
If ACE was found not to be liable because it was not brought into the action?
They just have to give notice of claim under the contract, don't you?
I can't think of a circumstance where ACE
wouldn't be.
Based upon what we're here for today, anything that's taken place up until this point, under what circumstances the employer would be held liable and not the insurer, since they're, under the contract, the insurer is required to pay those benefits.
We have the contract in this record.
No, we don't. All along, we've, as indicated by the administrative law judge decisions, we have been representing both parties, and I think the issue was raised in the circuit court under the Miller 1 holding that all parties must be named. Assuming that that's no longer the law, then the question is who is adverse, and there's been no suggestion or no evidence to show that they're not under contract obligated.
If that were a claim, that's another case. I mean, ACE has a complaint that I'm sure will let a court know.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. And you, When you'd asked about writing the decision, I thought one thing that could clarify or help question is whether anyone would act on it is if the statute said that you must name all insurers and employers as parties, then everyone would be on notice that you need to name all employers and insurers, and then you can determine whether they should be a plaintiff or a defendant, and that would clear everything up. I know the attorney in our office has 30 years of litigation experience, and he made a point to review the statute and thought he was doing everything right, and he got caught in this mix, as did a, there's a case that this case has already been cited once on a similar matter where the insurer wasn't, insurer or employer wasn't named. And I know there was, in the trial briefs, the Attorney General's office attached a copy of a circuit court decision where their case was dismissed for these same reasons based on Miller 2. So it's not like this is a novel issue.
No, this
it
all,
is a trap, frankly.
This all comes up because I think everything that preceded, I'm overstating this, everything preceding your complaint in the circuit court has John versus Excel and Ace, right? I mean, everything in the in Lurk, the captions of everything.
I'm sorry,
is,
it's really hard to hear with the band back there. Right.
And I really don't want to destroy the music. But everything in Lurk, the caption is the employee's name versus Excel and versus Ace, right? That's
yeah.
What that all is. You go to the circuit court and now your complaint is Excel versus Lurk and John, right?
Yep.
And it all, had you kept the same caption or at least just inverted it but included Ace, this case would not be here on that issue.
Well, we would be, there's the potential that the Attorney General could still file a motion to dismiss on the grounds that we had the insurer listed as a plaintiff.
I know. There's always that possibility, but it would have been in the caption, but it is in your complaint.
Okay. Oh, yeah, it's in the body of the complaint, yes. Yeah.
Any other comments? If not, I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and their arguments today on an issue that has come up in different contexts of who do you name when you move from an administrative agency to the court system, and how do you do it, and how can we avoid these disputes. So ends our hearing on 11 AP 203, Excel Energy Services versus Lurk.